Welcome to episode 286 of the Seahawkers podcast. I'm Brandon Schultz of the Military Seahawkers. And joining me to help recap the NFL Combine, talk a little bit of Seahawks football and free agency, Mr. Rob Staton of SeahawksDraftBlog.com. Rob, how you doing?
Great, Brandon. You know, we're finally past sort of the dull time in the NFL offseason. We've had the combine now. We've got a load of new information about certain players. And free agency is coming up, and we're already hearing a lot of trade rumors and stuff like that. So it's getting interesting now for the Seahawks.
Yeah, the biggest news to come out here this week is the interest in the Seahawks potentially have in pass rusher from Jacksonville, Yannick Ngakoue. And you know, this is interesting to me, the whole idea of going after Ngakoue, because there's so many different elements to it intertwined with the Jadeveon Clowney deal and whether or not they're potentially going to sign Clowney. Because the news leading up to this week, you heard the numbers come out of 18 to 20 million is kind of the range that the Seahawks would like to be in. And I think that's an important number coming out of the combine, because that's a time where the agents try and get together with the team, like the general manager, Pete Carroll. They're all together at the combine. So I know, though, that they don't want to necessarily set a floor amount number for Clowney, because then the agent's going to take that. They're going to shop it around to the other teams and try and get them to outbid. And what the Seahawks are trying to do, I think, leading up to the start of free agency in less than 2 weeks, is they want to make their final offer to Clowney before free agency starts. And because as soon as free agency opens, then the bidding can start and the number is likely to get beyond what the Seahawks want to do. So I think that $18 to $20 million number is probably lower than what their final offer would be to Clowney. And we can talk a little bit about how that plays in with Ngakoue, but what do you think just of that idea of re-signing Clowney and kind of what your number is that you're comfortable with bringing Clowney back in as a Seahawks pass rusher?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's exactly what is happening here. You know, it makes absolutely no sense for the Seahawks to say, hey, we're willing to go to 21 for you, because then you immediately set the lowest number at 21. So then he goes to all the other teams and say, hey, look, the Seahawks are offering 21. If you want to beat that, then and all of a sudden everything just elevates up higher. So the Seahawks offer 17-18, which is, you know, is the lowest amount. It's what Dee Ford got from the San Francisco 49ers a year ago. You know, Clowney's a better player than Dee Ford. So they set the bar at sort of like that $17 million a year range. And then he can go to other teams, and he isn't using the Seahawks as leverage. He's not going to play the Seahawks off against all these other teams and try and get that. So they let Clowney set his market. And I think you're right, a couple of days before free agency starts, or even during that legal tampering period, he will establish what the highest amount he's going to be offered is by other teams. And then the Seahawks will have a chance to match that or let him walk away, and we will see. So I do think that the Seahawks are playing this the right way. As far as what I personally would be comfortable with, it'd be something in the similar range that Frank Clark and DeMarcus Lawrence got. I think that, you know, Clowney is, you're not going to, listen, if you say like Clark and DeMarcus Lawrence are, what, about 20, 21, something like that. If you say that you're not willing to pay Jadeveon Clowney that, what are you going to do? Because are you going to pay Dante Fowler 18? You know, are you going to pay Jason Pierre-Paul in the teens? I mean, like the difference in, you're getting a player who's like 26 years old, who was in the peak of his years, you know, he fits in your locker room. Yeah, the sack numbers are there, but we've also seen what he's capable of, and he did it on his own last year. His pass rush percentage, win percentage is very high. It's the same as Joey Bosa's. He's a very talented player who you need to build around on your defensive line. If you are not willing to pay him like 21, but then you're only going to save like $3 or $4 million to sign somebody else. So you might as well just have Jadeveon Clowney and then build from there. And then you've got to support him. You've got to bring other players in. I think one of the big mistakes, Brandon, that a lot of people make is they look at the Seahawks cap space in 2020. It's like a hard number. And if you sign a player on $21 million a year, for example, you just eliminate 21. So let's say the Seahawks have $45 million cap space and then Clowney signs for 21. It doesn't just go down to $24 million left after that. Frank Clark's cap hit in 2019 was $6.5 million. I think DeMarcus Lawrence's was about $11 million and Khalil Mack's was somewhere in between that. Mm-hmm. So you can structure contracts and you can make things happen. The cash-rich teams, like the Seahawks, got a lot of cash to spend, can pretty much do and structure deals however they want to give up front money that doesn't affect the cap and vice versa. So if you actually wanted to go and sign Jadeveon Clowney and Yannick Ngakoue this offseason, you could do that. It might mean that you're a bit tight against the cap 2 or 3 years down the line, but then 2 or 3 years down the line, KJ Wright's not going to be on the books, and Justin Britton, I mean, they might not be on the books this year, but they're not definitely going to be books in sort of 2 or 3 years' time. There'll be one or two other players. Dwayne Brown might not be on the books in 2 or 3 years' time. You might be able to justify having those big salaries. And here's the other thing that people need to remember. What is the salary cap going to be in 2 or 3 years' time? Right. So if you have Jadeveon Clowney on $21 million a year, and let's say Ngakoue on the exact same amount, it sounds really expensive now, but you can actually structure their deals so their cap hits are quite low in year one. And in 2 or 3 years' time, when their cap hits are high, that might just be the market value for a pass rusher at the time, because the price is just going to go up and up and up as the gambling money comes in and the new CBA comes in and the cap space dramatically increases, which is what everybody expects. So I think actually there are opportunities, in much greater opportunities than I think a lot of fans realize. I think there seems to be this attitude among Seahawks fans to like sneer at any possibility of actually doing anything on the pass rush, that they can only sign one player and that's it. No, you can do some things. You can be creative. You can add players to this pass rush. And if there's one thing the Seahawks do when they have a massive need, is they go after it and they attack it. Doesn't always work, but you can never accuse them of not being bold. And I think they're going to be bloody bold this year, and I think they're going to try and fix this pass rush.
And I think one of the things that people get scared of is that $20 million number, especially for a player on the defensive line. And I think that goes back 4 or 5 years ago, because when you saw teams that were paying guys $20 million on the defensive line, they didn't have enough money to pay the rest of the team. But salary caps have gone up, and now $20 million is just the price it takes to find a guy who can rush the quarterback well. So I think we're shifting to a number that just, it's a benchmark that tends to scare people away a little bit. It takes us to this discussion about Yannick Ngakoue and whether or not, you know, with the Seahawks coming out, Tony Pauline reports that the Seahawks might be willing to give up a first round pick, their first second round pick, which is the second to last pick in the second round, and potentially get the first pick in the second round that the Jaguars have. So swapping essentially second round picks, giving up the first round pick, they move up in round two, they get Ngakoue, they get the opportunity to sign him to a long-term deal. I don't think that they would just be making the trade to get him on a one-year deal. I think they'd be making a trade to sign him long-term, much like the Chiefs did with Frank Clark, like the 49ers did with Dee Ford, because if you give up that much, you have to sign the guy for the long-term. It just doesn't make sense otherwise. I'm curious, though, if this, because I think it could signal a couple different things that are going on. One, it could signal that they've decided to move on from Clowney. And I think based off of all of our discussion, you and I don't believe that to be true, because there's still plenty of time before the deadline for them to make a final offer for Clowney. But maybe they've got the signal from Clowney that he wants to go elsewhere. So I think it's a possibility to consider. They could be trying to gauge the market, because doing this negotiation now, getting the trade in place, getting an idea from his agent of what Ngakoue might be asking, it helps set the market for what they could offer to Clowney. They could just be doing their due diligence in case a deal with Clowney ultimately does fall through. Or, best case scenario, is that they want him in addition to Clowney.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different options here. And I mean, personally, listening to Pete Carroll, when he actually did an interview with John Clayton at the Combine, and I put the quote on the blog, and he was saying that, you know, what they really, really want is a premier pass rusher. I mean, I think I've got the quote here. I'll dig it out a little bit later, actually. So he was saying that the first thing, first of all, they want to get is like a Leo premier pass rusher who can get after the quarterbacks. That's the one thing they did not have last year. You know, they had Clowney, who was destroying the occasional game and was defending the run very well and was impacting. What they didn't have was that really dynamic Leo pass rusher, and they've got to try and find that somewhere. Now, when you actually look at Yannick Ngakoue, I don't think his physical profile is what you'd predominantly associate with a Leo pass rusher. You know, Cliff Averill ran a fantastic 1.50 10-yard split, which is just unheard of for a pass rusher. Bruce Irvin had an unbelievable combine Frank Clark ran a short shuttle that was comparable to a defensive back at 270 pounds. So they've always gone for these like major athletes, but they did use Chris Clemens in that role. And actually, when you look at the physical profiles between Chris Clemens and Yannick Ngakoue, they're almost identical. So, you know, I don't know what his fit will be like as the Leo, but presumably if they did make this trade, they would think that they're drafting a young Chris Clemens 2.0 sort of thing. So, you know, that's one. I do think they're going to really go after Clowney. And if they don't sign Clowney, the other point of this, bringing up this John Clayton interview, is that Carroll said specifically they want the Leo and they want the five technique. And the five technique is somebody who rushes inside out a little bit, defends the run very well, but can also rush the passer and play Leo if they need to as well. Now, obviously, they were hoping that LJ Collier was going to do that role. Right. You can't have any faith in him doing that in 2020 after what he showed as a rookie. He's going to have to be somebody who works into a rotation and competes this year to get into a position to do that. I think if Clowney moves on, I think they're going to target somebody in free agency to come in and do that. And that could easily be Arik Armstead, who has done that kind of role nowhere near as well as Clowney. He's not the same kind of player as Clowney, but he plays end, plays left end, dips inside for San Francisco. I think he could be the backup plan for Clowney if Clowney moves on. And then you're looking at Leo options, and I think Ngakoue's one, Everson Griffin's another option for them who might be a little bit cheaper. There may be one or two other options out there as well, but I think they're going to combine players. You know, they had Clowney last year, and Clowney alone was not enough, and it won't be enough in 2020 either. They need a Leo, but if they bring in the Leo, they're going to need the Clowney replacement. So they're going to have to bring guys in. And, you know, they were at the most effective when they had sort of two or three really prominent pass rushers on this defense. They've clearly identified the defensive line as the main issue, and they're going to go after it. And they are going to sign, they'll either sign multiple players and draft somebody, or they will just concentrate on free agency and leave the draft open. But I think it's going to be a very aggressive plan. I think everything right at the moment is posturing. You know, any talk of Clowney might go here, or the Seahawks don't want to pay this, or another team's interested in him. It's all posturing. It's all positioning. It's all trying to gain leverage. It's all trying to sort of work your angles ahead of free agency. That's what's happening right now. And then we have to wait another week, 10 days to kind of find out exactly how this is going to play down. But the Seahawks are not going to, they're not going to be conservative with this. You know, they cannot waste another season. We cannot be sat here in a year saying they did not fix the pass rush and they wasted another season. It has to be fixed. We cannot be talking about this in a year. And I'm absolutely convinced that whatever, whether it works or not, in 3 weeks' time, we'll be sitting here saying they've addressed it.
Yeah. And I think probably their best option to build their defensive line is going to be re-signing Clowney, maybe even re-signing Jaron Reed, depending on what that number could be. And then rather than going out and trying to use all this cap space that you have to try and find three guys, if you've got Reed and Clowney, then you're talking about finding, you know, maybe just one guy and then also drafting a guy. So I do want to get into the draft. Obviously, if they make a trade for Ngakoue, it kind of blows up one of the other opportunities that you were talking about on your blog. One of those unrealistic things that are unlikely to happen, but really fun to talk about. Yeah. And that's trading for Isaiah Simmons. And, you know, if you talk about guys coming into this 2020 draft, I think we talked about it too after the national championship game. Isaiah Simmons is just one of those guys that just jumps off the screen and looks like he could be a player with long-term success in the NFL. And just that idea of what would you have to put together to potentially trade up to take a guy who you feel could be an impact player on your defense for multiple years to come. Are the Seahawks in position to be able to make that happen if they chose to go after it?
Yeah, and look at it, you know, when I wrote the piece, I think I said three times, this isn't, you know, I'm not suggesting for a second this is a realistic proposal, but it, you know, there's a lot of days between a draft and the end of a season, you know, you have to fill them somehow. And, you know, if you're just going to sort of, you know, say no to everything, I mean, we, you know, we've talked about in the past, Brandon, that the league's, it's an unpredictable league. And I think some people kind of act like, you know, nothing interesting ever happens in the NFL when the exact opposite is true, you know, crazy, unexpected things happen all of the time. We saw one this week. Who thought that Trey Turner and Russell Okung would be traded in a swap? You know, and you see things happen all the time. You know, I don't think anybody was predicting Atlanta and Julio Jones when that happened, or Kansas City and Patrick Mahomes when that happened. So look, trades happen, and let's see. The precedent isn't there for the Seahawks making a big move up like this, but the kind of case that I made for it, you know, as a potential option, is just simply that I've done the blog for 11 years. And people ask every year, is there somebody that they might trade up for? Is there somebody that you would trade up for? And I've always said no, because I think if you're going to give up future first round picks because you don't know where you're going to be in a year, you're like one quarterback injury away from that being a top 10 pick. And that ends up being a very risky proposition. So I never quite feel comfortable trading, you know, really high future picks for players that there's just an element of unknown there for. But if you were ever going to do it, it had to be for somebody that you felt that ticked every box. It had to be somebody who had an outstanding physical profile, an amazing upside, which Isaiah Simmons has got. You know, he ran a, you know, very similar 40 time to DK Metcalf, and he weighs, what, like 15 pounds heavier than him. It's an incredible physical profile, very explosive, very quick, very fast, very big, very long. He's got complete package in terms of athleticism.
He can play all over the field. He can play linebacker. He can play safety. Exactly. He can play on the outside.
He's incredibly versatile. So it might be that one game, like, you have to defend George Kittle twice a season, at least three times if you play him in the playoffs. The Seahawks have not done a very good, nobody's done a very good job of covering George Kittle. Now you've got a 238-pound linebacker slash safety who you could specifically say your job's just to eliminate George Kittle in a game. And he may not be able to do it, but he may, but that's your best chance at trying to cover somebody like that. It's having somebody like Isaiah Simmons having a chance to do it. If you need to spy Kyler Murray twice a season, at least. How poorly did they do containing Lamar Jackson and Kyler Murray in 2019? Now you've got somebody who could do that. You've got somebody who's been a tackle for a loss machine playing off the edge. He could play a bit of, he could do what Michael Kendricks did last year, but he's quicker and he's more, you know, he's got better coverage skills, but he could also rush. You could play him off the edge on third down. You could have him as the most dynamic, strong safety in the league if you wanted to. You could have him as the long-term successor to KJ Wright. Well, this is one of the issues, is that you'd have to work out what his best role is and then you'd have to kind of stick to it. But the options are limitless. And the other thing that he ticks the box with is the character. You know, he was like the emotional leader of the Clemson team. This is not a knucklehead that you're bringing in, like, you know, and you're taking a huge gamble on. This is somebody who has led the way for Clemson, won a national championship with them, and, you know, got to another national championship. And it was only the brilliance of LSU that, you know, prevented them from winning back-to-back national championships. And he and Trevor Lawrence were like the main two players for that. He was the Trevor Lawrence of the defense, essentially. So, look, the other thing, you know, the reason I brought it up is simply because it's incredible, really, how the number 27 pick has been used. It's been a position from where teams have traded up quite aggressively in the past. So Atlanta traded from 27 up to get Julio Jones. Kansas City traded from 27 to get Mahomes. New Orleans traded from 27 to get Marcus Davenport. You know, teams have moved up from here into the top 10 in the past. So if he was there, you know, he's going to have to last to like 6-7 at least for this to be even remotely realistic. But if he was there and you could move up and you got Clowney and a pass rusher and then you threw Isaiah Simmons onto the field, I do think that would elevate the Seahawks defense. And the one thing that I think everybody would agree is that, yes, they need more on the defense, but they also need some real quality. They need an injection of quality on that defense. They've tried to reset and rebuild this defense, you know, with a pick here, a pick there, you know, a free agent signing here, a cheap free agent signing there, and it's not really had the impact that it had in the past. They need some talent. They need to go and get some guys that are really good. And, you know, sometimes that means being a little bit aggressive. And this is one way to potentially do it, go and get Isaiah Simmons. But equally, I acknowledge that they've never done this, and he could be the number three overall pick, and then it becomes a non-starter. So, you know, it's just an interesting talking point.
Yeah, number three overall would be definitely out of the range for the Seahawks' ability to trade up. But looking at Daniel Jeremiah, now I know you disparaged him earlier in this podcast already, but he is at number seven, interestingly enough, in his mock draft 2.0 coming out of the combine. So it is right in that sweet spot. But let's go ahead and disparage Daniel Jeremiah again, because I go down and guess what position he has selected for the Seahawks to take with number 27 overall, but cornerback Trayvon Diggs, a cornerback in round one for the Seahawks. I'm so tired of seeing corners mocked to the Seahawks. And here he has originally in his 1.0, he had Ross Blacklock going to the Seahawks at a TCU, but now he has Blacklock going down to 32, and he's moved a cornerback into that position.
Well, you know, I'm starting to wonder whether the term mock draft has actually got a different meaning. It means it's to mock Seahawks fans. You can never have a viable mock draft to read, because like everything, like Ross Blacklock's got he's got sub 33 inch arms. We know that they're not going to go in that. We know they're not going to take a cornerback early. Daniel Jeremiah's given him a corner. Mike Renner from Pro Football Focus actually did a mock draft this week, and then he did a video discussing it, and he went, as we all know, the Seahawks don't take cornerbacks with short arms. You know, they like long physical cornerbacks. And AJ Terrell is exactly that type. He has 31-inch arms. You know, he's got short arms. You know, so that, you know, yes, you're right. They don't take cornerbacks with short arms, but they don't take any cornerbacks in round one. And he has short arms. And then Dane Brugler brought one out from The Athletic.
Cynthia Freeland, who does all of the analytics and building models, and she talks about all the stuff that she's put into her model that takes into account all these things that the organization does, all the things, their biggest needs, and how it affects their points at the end of the day. And all of that, after putting all of that into her model, it comes out with AJ Terrell to the Seahawks. So I mean, another corner.
But the great thing is, like, somebody, like I will tweet something and say, oh, the Seahawks maybe interested in this guy. And someone will come on and go, I think you'll find that in this mock draft, AJ Terrell is the guy for the Seahawks. And it's just, I think it is somewhat frustrating. But look, the national media, they don't follow the Seahawks in the way that maybe we do, right, as diehard, you know, Seahawks followers. So I you know, I kind of give them a little bit of a pass.
But
I feel
like the idea that the Seahawks were bad at rushing the quarterback last year, I feel like that was, even on the national media scale, like that was a big talking point. So I don't think any of us would be upset if they were predicting somebody along the defensive line.
Yeah, I mean, if any of them are listening, you know, just log on to the draft blog. You know, we've got all the details on there. You know, the kind of things that they look for, and it's not particularly hard to just sort of do a bit of digging and kind of get a fit, especially for the teams that have got established GMs and head coaches, to kind of find the trends there. So yeah, it is a little bit frustrating, but you know, I think looking at the draft off the back of the combine, Brandon, I thought it was a particularly frustrating combine, a disappointing combine. One, a number of top prospects didn't work out. And I fear that that's going to be a trend. I think agents say, you know, agents threatened the NFL and said, if you switch this to prime time and you have our guys working out late at night, we're just going to pull them out. And that's what happened. A number of the top prospects didn't do anything. Some of them would run a 40 and then do the drills, but then they wouldn't do the agility testing because it was taking place at 10 o'clock at night, which is just ridiculous. They'll just wait till the pro day to do it, if at all. If you are going to put the combine on at prime time, you can't then have all of your top prospects not performing. Otherwise, what's the point of it? Who wants to watch sort of like, here's a fifth round pick running a 40? You know, you need your big name college players to actually be attending these events. They've got to try and shift this around for next year, either move it back or give these players move it earlier, or give the players an incentive, a financial incentive, to actually be competing in the combine. Yeah. We saw a lot of injuries. We saw players pulling hamstrings because it was late in the day. There was talk of players being forced to kind of sit around for 6 hours until the evening to do their workouts. It looked like an absolute shower of a combine. So hopefully they will get that sorted. But the options for the defensive line groups were terrible. There was nothing there. You know, no Seahawks from that. The linebackers, there was nothing obvious there apart from Willie Gay, who we knew about, we talked about before going into the combine. You know, we knew he was going to do what he did. There were hardly any cornerbacks with 32-inch arms, which is, you know, I don't think I've seen so few cornerbacks that fit the Seahawks' preference actually working out at a combine. It was astonishing, really. The last 2 days were a washout. At least there was some good news. The offensive line, very positive. I think the receivers are a bit underwhelming, but there's clearly a lot of talented receivers in this draft. Some very good running backs. Jonathan Taylor had an outstanding performance and has been begging the Seahawks to draft him at the combine as well. So he's probably, I can imagine him being in like the top 10 on their board because he just ticks everything that they look for. And then I actually thought there were one or two safeties who did quite well as well, you know. And so there are players out there, but I have to say, I look at number 27 and I'm struggling. There are players that they will like who will be off the board by 27. And I'm not really liking the options at 27. I like the options a lot more in round two and round three than I do probably at the end of round one.
Well, and I wonder too if that plays into this idea of, based on the performance at the combine, if John Schneider looked at that and said, okay, maybe I need to start looking for an edge rusher that's available as a free agent who is a franchise tag player. And that's why this Ngakoue trade is coming up at this time after the combine. So let's take that into this edge class, Rob, because is there something that he potentially saw that maybe none of these guys would be available ultimately with that 27th pick that is going to excite him?
You're absolutely right. There isn't anybody There just isn't. There's Julian Aquara, who did not work at the combine because he is recovering from a broken leg still and wasn't 100%. I don't know if he's going to do a pro day. So we're going to have an incomplete physical profile on him. And they generally haven't taken players. I'm struggling to think. I don't think there's anybody who's not done anything before the draft who they've taken with their first pick. They usually like to know what they're getting with the first player that they draft. So we'll have to see if he does anything at the pro day. And then you've got Jabari Zuniga from Florida, who doesn't have 33-inch arms. He's got 32 three-quarter-inch arms, or 32 7/8 or something like that.
Pretty close.
So he's as close as anything. You know, if he put a pair of gloves on, he'd probably have 33-inch arms. You know, he's an option as well. Worked out very well. A player that we were mocking to the Seahawks a year ago. He didn't declare, but he's now in this draft, and I think he's, you know, like a mid-round pick. He could be an option. That's pretty much it. There's nobody else that looks like a Seahawks pass rusher. And they know, they've admitted, they've told us, both Pete and John have said, that fixing the pass rush is the priority. And if they can't do it in the draft, and they're not going to be able to do it by signing, you know, multiple free agents, they have to look at that number 27 pick as an asset to acquire what they need. And yes, I think that very much so. If they don't believe they can sign two or three pass rushers in the open market without spending that number 27, they're going to have to use it on somebody else. I think it's a little bit unfortunate. It would be ideal if they didn't have to do that, because I do think there are players you could move up a little bit and get, or you could move back into round two and get some nice picks in round two and round three that, you know, you could get some plenty of options there. But, you know, they have to fix their needs. And look, in 2013, they looked at the class and thought, that's nobody there. We'll go and get Percy Harvin. In 2015, they thought, oh, we've just lost the Super Bowl because we didn't have a red zone threat. There's nobody in the draft. Let's go and get Jimmy Graham. And now they're looking at it and thinking, well, I don't see any pass rushers here. We're going to have to go and get somebody. Let's go and get Yannick Ngakoue. And I think it's a very, very good chance that that number 27 pick will be traded for somebody on the pass rush. And if it's not Ngakoue, it could be somebody on an existing contract who they don't have to negotiate with, they don't have to sign to a new deal, who might actually be at a cheaper cost because the other team will take on the dead money, like happened with Jadeveon Clowney. So that could be an option as well.
Well, if you move back to linebacker, I'm wondering if there's any of these guys who tested that were, you know, maybe on the larger side for what the Seahawks tend to look for at linebacker, but maybe have that kind of speed that they like at the edge. If a guy like Zach Bond, Kenneth Murray from Oklahoma, Malik Harrison, maybe of Ohio State. You mentioned Willie Gay Jr., who's probably a day three type prospect, right? But he has all of those particular traits that the Seahawks look for. Are they all kind of linebacker type skill set, or do they have that ability to rush the passer?
I just don't think Zach Bourne, I mean, he's somebody who sometimes gets mocked to the Seahawks. I just don't think he fits their profile. I mean, he has short arms, didn't run a great 40, not particularly explosive. His short shuttle is a 4.31. You know, when they've taken players to play like Sam Leo, we're talking about like 4.0s with like Bruce Irvin and Frank Clark and stuff like that. So he's not really the kind of player that they look for. You know, Caleb on Chasen didn't work out. I think he's very overrated, but you know, he didn't have the 33-inch arms. So, you know, is that it's a determining factor for him? There isn't really anybody. You know, Curtis Weaver had a better than expected combine, but he doesn't have 33-inch arms. And I think he's more of he's a weird fit. He's kind of a real, like, he's got the body of an end, but he worked out the linebackers and he's lost weight. He's lost he's gone from 300 pounds to like 260 odd. I just don't see a Seahawk there. I didn't see anybody. I really did not see, there was nobody that made me feel, go and get him. I mean, there was, the players that I kind of looked at and thought, they were all at different positions. So you see Jonathan Taylor run and you see him test and you see him, you go back and watch the test, and you know, he's everything that the Seahawks want in a running back apart from the fumbles. He's the definitive Seahawks running back, and I bet they would love to draft him, but they're probably not going to be able to because it's a luxury pick and they love Chris Carson, and he may be, I think I could easily see him going in the teens. Do you know what? It wouldn't surprise me if he went top 12. Because he performed that well, yeah. His measurables are the same as Saquon Barkley, pretty much. I wouldn't be surprised if he went a lot earlier than people. A surprise pick could be him going a lot earlier than, you know, the other running backs. You know, Dodger Swift, you've got Clyde Edwards-Helaire. You know, he didn't run a great time, but he's incredibly explosive. He was expected. I love Clyde Edwards-Helaire, as you know from the last podcast we did. offensive line, lots of explosive, very athletic offensive linemen. You know, there are tons of options there. You're going to see them flying off the board in the top 15.
And that's, you know, part of my concern too with the offensive line. Are there so many good offensive linemen, and there's such a need for offensive line around the league. Who's going to be left when it comes time for the Seahawks to pick at the end of round one?
Yeah, it's a fair point, because I think what you're going to see is, I genuinely believe that Mekhi Becton and Andrew Thomas and Tristan Wirfs and Austin Jackson are going to go in the top 15. And, you know, I think Jedrick Wills, you see, you just look at Jedrick Wills looks like a guard. He does not look like an offensive tackle. And, you know, people rave at his eyes, the best defensive tackle, and he's this, that, and the other. He's getting a top four. I think people are going to judge him as a guard, a very athletic and explosive guard, but that will temper some of his... Look, guards go early. We've seen it with Sherp. We've seen it with Nelson. He could still go in the top 10 as a guard prospect, but I think that's how teams will view it. But he will go early as well. Cleveland, Ezra Cleveland is flying up the boards now because of his fantastic workout. And, you know, I think they could all be gone by 27. And then you've got Isaiah Wilson. And I thought he was a fantastic... He's the second. So we did the TEF, and we did the TEF testing, the weighted TEF. He was number two in weighted TEF. You know, our results show if you are a big, explosive, offensive lineman, you are going early in the draft. He's a big, explosive, offensive lineman. He will go early in the draft. It's just a case of whether he goes top 20, you know, whether there's a team that goes, we want him as our right guard, or whether he lasts, right tackle, sorry, or if he lasts to sort of like Minnesota at 25. They could use a right tackle. They drafted Phil Loadholt back in the day. You know, they could well look at him. Miami at 26 could look at him. They could draft two tackles and bookend and go with that. They need the tackles. There are lots of teams that could look at someone like Isaiah Wilson. And if he's gone as well, then, you know, you really are sort of thinking, right, is Prince Tagovailoa, is he going to do any workouts? Is Lucas Niang going to be healthy? You know, there are medical question marks for those two players. You know, big question marks is whether anybody's going to be there then. So that's that position. And then, you know, you look at the safety position. I thought Antoine Winfield Jr. Wow. You know, there were two players that nobody's talking about after the combine, Brandon, who were absolutely marvelous in the way that they tested. Antoine Winfield Jr. ran faster than expected, did everything well in terms of the tests. His on-field drills were sensational. He moved around that field with such fluidity and quickness and sharpness and suddenness. He looked fantastic. He, for me, looked like a top 40 pick as a safety. And he's got the production and the bloodlines, of course, from the NFL. I thought he was amazing. I thought he was one of the big winners of the combine. Nobody really seems to be paying him much attention, but he was fantastic. I know there's a medical question mark with him. People are going to dig into the medicals and see that. That's been flagged. If he gets a clean bill of health, I think he'd go a lot earlier than people are projecting at the moment. And the other player who really stood out, KJ Hamler, didn't do any of the on-field drills or the tests because he got an injury. But he did the bench press. He is 178 pounds. He did 15 reps. Like, do people understand how incredible that is? To be 178 pounds and rep, like 1% of the world's population can bench press their own body weight. 1%. He bench pressed 50 pounds more than his weight. That was 20 times more impressive than any of the offensive or defensive linemen did on the bench press. You know, he's pushing that was incredible. And if he's that dedicated to the weight room to be able to do 15 reps at 178, if he's got that natural strength, then we know he can run because we've seen it on the tape. He's going to go a damn sight earlier than people think. Teams are going to notice that. He's a freak. So I thought those two guys deserved a lot more attention.
See, I thought you were going to bring up Kyle Duggar, who also was pretty impressive in some of the drills for safety.
Yeah, I mean, he was the thing with Kyle Duggar is, and this is the problem, when you tell people you're going to run a 4.3 and then you run a 4.50, you end up coming out afterwards going, you know, and it's a disappointing. If he'd not said anything, then people would have gone, 4.50 was a fair time. But because he was promising a 4.3, and apparently had been timed as such. I mean, the thing is, the safety is tested so late in the day. You know, we've talked about that already. You know, it's not conducive to a good performance. And I wouldn't be surprised if he ran a 4.3 down the line. But he jumped very well. You know, Jeremy Chin did as well. I was a bit underwhelmed by Jeremy Chin's tape, to be honest. But, you know, he did it. He had a great performance too. The safeties did well. And, you know, and I feel a little bit validated. You know, Xavier McKinney didn't run very well. And I've kind of been predicting that. I think he's overrated, and you know, Chase Young bailed on the combine because he was going to run badly, which we've talked about an awful lot. So I kind of feel like we confirmed a few things at this combine, and we learn a lot. But for me, the strength of the draft is kind of 50 to 100. It's not necessarily number 27.
Well, one of the areas of strength in the draft and was talked about quite a bit was the wide receiver area. And when you're drafting in that 50 to 100 area, it seems like there's going to be a lot of guys there. Did seeing how they performed in the broad and the vertical with their 40 times, did that kind of back up what you were thinking going into the combine?
I thought the receivers were a little bit underwhelming because I think I think a lot of people were expecting blazing 40 times. Mm-hmm. Jalen Reagor, for example, ran a 4.47 instead of a 4.3. 4.47 is fine. And he had gained weight, good weight as well. I mean, he looked very muscular.
Yeah.
But he didn't run a 4.3. And then, you know,
Brandon Ayuk didn't. He ran 4.5.
He's a 4.50. And, you know, I was thinking maybe 4.45 for him. I just, you know, there were so many frustrating things at the combine. Like the whole Justin Jefferson thing really wound me up because people were going, whoa, he's run a 4.45. That's a lot quicker than expected. I was like, have you watched him play? Like the guy was he ran a 4.43. I thought, if you just asked, honestly, hand on heart, if you said, what do you think Justin Jefferson's going to run? And I said a 4.45. And he ran a 4.43.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the NFL Network and Daniel Jeremiah went, that's a lot faster than expected. He was on the Ian Rapoport podcast today. He's like, I don't know, where did that all come from? What did you think I was going to run? I was like, exactly. You know, it was just what was your expectation of his run? But then he gets built up as having a great day. Oh, he's had an amazing performance. What a run. A 4.43, that's a lot quicker than expected. That's what he was. That's what, if you watch the tape, he looked like a 4.4 kind of runner. That's what he ended up being. So I think that, you know, Denzel Mims performed very well. You know, everyone's talking about him as a first round pick. As a consequence of that, Chase Claypool tested very well. The one or two, Quinton Cephas ran like around 4.7 or something like that. So that was disappointing there. I actually have a theory that the Seahawks might strangely pass on this class or draft one later on. Mm. I just think that I don't think at 20, if they still hold on to 27, I'm not sure that I think there's going to be a run on receivers, and I'm not sure there's going to be one that they think we've got to have this guy at 27. And what I actually think they might do is draft one on day three. They love a receiver in round four, Brandon, don't they? So they might take one of these.
Not another round four receiver, Rob.
Yeah, they might take one of these 4.4 runners at the end of round four. Let's just throw it out there.
Uh-huh.
When the combine started, and I don't want to put two and two and get five here, but when the combine started, one of the first clips they showed on the first day was Pete and John in the booth or whatever they have the corporate facilities where they stick the teams. And John's busy eating himself with something, and Pete kind of nudges him and says, "Look, John," and points down at the field because Hunter Bryant was running.
Hmm.
And I found that was very interesting because I think they might take him instead of a receiver. The Seahawks, as we've kind of identified in the preview, short shuttle, three cone.
Yeah.
Matters for tight ends. If you run a short shuttle that's really good, you're in with a chance. I didn't mention this in the last podcast we did. They haven't drafted a tight end who's run a slower than a 7.10 three cone. Every single one is quicker than a 7.10. That's considered a really good time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Hunter Bryant, there were four tight ends who had a good short shuttle and a sub-7.10 three cone, of which Hunter Bryant was one. Adam Trautman was another. Tamapu was the other one. And Dalton Keene was the other. So they're the four tight ends who did it. Now, when you actually watch Hunter Bryant, he is a fantastic big slot type receiver. And he has the quickness and the agility that we know they like at that position. Now, a year ago, they didn't draft a tight end, even though there was a lot of tight ends that fit their what they like. But they did afterwards trade specifically for Jacob Hollister. And he is not a typical Seahawks tight end. They went after Hollister because they wanted a skill set. They wanted a move tight end. They wanted a complement to Will Disley and to Nick Bonetto, who was there, and Ed Dixon. They wanted somebody who could do what Hollister did for them in 2019. And as we saw, you know, mainly because of injuries, he ended up having quite a significant role in the end. But I think they really wanted to add that to the offense last year. Now, it'd be quite expensive to tender Hollister. I think it's like $2 million. It might cost them $2 million. They might feel that that's not value for money to do that in order to keep him, mm-hmm. when you could actually spend a lot less to draft somebody for that role. Now, Hunter Bryant it ticks a lot of boxes for the Seahawks, character-wise. He comes from a school that has taught the tight ends to block. He does block on tape. People will tell you he doesn't. He does. Watch the games. He blocks. And he, you would never call him a Will Disley standard blocker, but he gives great effort, and he more often than not gets the job done. So he won't be a liability there, in my opinion. And he's a fantastic, he's got great ability to find little areas and crossing routes. He can go deep, corner routes. He can do all of the things that you want a guy in his position to do. And the fact that he tested in their bracket for the short shuttle and the three cone, and the fact that Pete was very specifically nudging John, keep an eye on this guy, Hunter Bryant's here now. We're going to watch him run his 40. And the fact that they brought in Hollister a year ago makes me think that actually what they want is that complement to Disley and Olsen. And they might actually bring him in instead of a receiver to play in the slot and to do some of those roles. And just a quick final point, because I know this is a very long-winded answer. Aaron Hernandez, obviously a very controversial person.
Yeah, he didn't do all that well in the NFL. Well, he did on the field, but off the field, he had his issues.
On the field, when he was playing for New England, was quite a productive receiver, wasn't he? Playing as an alternative to Gronkowski. Mm-hmm. He tested very similarly to Hunter Bryant. Mm. So, you know, you look at the 4.70, I think he ran in the 40, or maybe just a bit quicker than that. You know, people will say, oh, I expected a bit more from him. Well, actually, the physical profile is there. Hunter Bryant's been training with Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright and is an absolute machine. He's in incredible shape. And I just have a feeling that the Seahawks might actually look at him and say, that's a player we kind of want to come away with. And the fact that he didn't test amazingly at the combine might mean that instead of round two, does he last a bit longer? Does he drift into round three? Maybe even late? I don't think he'd drop later than that. Could they actually get him a decent value? And could he be the player that they use in the slot as an upgrade on Jacob Hollister, who is actually cheaper, rather than going all out and drafting a receiver? And that would enable them to focus maybe some of their earlier draft stock on defensive line and offensive line if they wanted to.
Well, and one of the nice things too, with the restricted free agency, I don't think that they have to actually make a decision on offering those restricted free agent tenders until after the draft, if I remember right. I think that's early May, mid-May type time frame. So that would allow them to get through the draft. And if they were able to pick up a Hollister replacement, then that makes the decision easy on Hollister. You just give them, you know, unrestricted tender or whatever it is, the minimum amount of tender, or you try and re-sign him, and maybe the likelihood is that he's gone. But the main point I'm making is that you don't have to make that decision then until after the draft and see if you get him.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a great point. And yeah, it's just really for me, we can all sort of talk about, you know, will they do this? Will they do that? You know, none of us know. You know, we're all guessing. I think that the one thing I like to do, well, you've got a combine and you can sort of look through the class and you can say who could be a Seahawk. And, you know, with some of the trends that we've identified with like the tight ends and cornerbacks and offensive linemen and stuff like that, it enables us to sort of just cut down the numbers and sort of say, well, this could be an option. And you know what? The draft might come around. They might not go anywhere near Hunter Bryant, and it just will be something that we've talked about and we won't talk about after the draft. But, you know, it's logical. You know, the proposal that they would, you know, that they specifically traded for Hollister to get that type of player on their offense, that Brian Schottenheimer and Russell Wilson think, yes, you know, you have a big tight end who can block on one side and you have a big slot / joker type on the other, and you have two tight ends, you know, they can be dynamic weapons, you've got speed on the outside as well, that could be something that, and I think he's, I know he had some drops, but I think he is quite a natural catcher. I think that he is somebody that they could look at. And look, there was, you know, Jonathan Taylor looks like a Seahawk. Hunter Bryant for me looks like he could be an option for them. I thought that Nick Harris had a brilliant combine, and he's, you know, people look at that and go, well, he's short arms and he's small. Yeah, well, so is Joey Hunt. And they drafted him and they really liked him. And Nick Harris, leader, gritty, determined, has overcome adversity because of his size. You know, I could see them being interested in him. And then you have some of the bigger names. You know, your Cesar Ruiz has had a fantastic combine. Isaiah Wilson and Kyle Duggar and people like that. And then you look a little bit lower, Hakeem Adeniji could be an option for them. Or a Cam Akers, if they don't get a running back early, they could look at somebody like that. There are lots of different players that they could view, and I don't think it's a particularly great draft class for where Seahawks are picking, but I think there are some nice pockets where you can actually get good players and players that fit the Seahawks and players that could provide value. So I in that regard, look, I think that It's just popped into my head, Brandon. There is one other player that I think we really have to mention from the combine. I thought Jalen Hurts was fantastic at the combine. And I will not be surprised whatsoever if teams who people assume are going to take a quarterback in the top 10, take an offensive lineman in the top 10 instead, because that's when the rush is going to start there, and then consider Jalen Hurts round two or round three range, because he was fantastic.
He was. And, you know, Hurts is a guy that I struggle with myself, because as we saw him in the Senior Bowl, and I know we talked about him as a guy that, you know, if he's around in round four to round five, he did have a solid combine, but he was throwing, he wasn't under pressure at the combine. And I think that was one of the things that we saw with him in Oklahoma. He never really had to worry about pressure. He was throwing to guys who were schemed wide open. So, but the Senior Bowl, when you saw him on the run, accuracy was just such a big issue for him.
I think the thing with him is that I always kind of wondered whether or not he had the arm talent and the ability to do the things you need to do at the next level. And you know, I just couldn't take my eyes off the screen, you know, when he was on there at the combine, because the ball was flying out of his hand. It was accurate. It was with velocity. He just looked like a natural passer. He had this big grin on his face. He looked like he was having fun. You know, a huge grin on his face. And actually, when you look at it, and it's kind of the funny thing, really, because we all say, you know, you draft certain positions early and, you know, you can get these other positions later on. You know, you can get a running back in round seven. It doesn't matter. And you can, you know, you've got to get a quarterback in the top 10 otherwise. And you actually look across the league and you think, Russell Wilson's a third round pick and he's as good as any quarterback in the league. Lamar Jackson was the MVP. You took him at the end of round one. Dak Prescott's a fourth round pick. Tom Brady was a sixth round pick. Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota were one and two.
Yeah.
Jared Goff and Carson Wentz were one and two. Patrick Mahomes was number 10 in the year that Mitchell Trubisky was number three.
Right.
And you just think, well, actually, you know what? You can pretty much get a talented player at any position, at any point in the draft.
Yeah.
You either just have to be really, really good at talent evaluation, or you have to be lucky, or a bit of both.
Well, look at Gardner Minshew, who's going to be starting for the Jaguars next year. You know, they picked him up late in the draft too. So I think Hurts is a guy too who is going to crush it in the interview process too. You know, just a charismatic guy. You know, I'm sure he could say all the right things. And you know, when we saw him throwing the football around, obviously looks the part. It's maybe it just takes him being in the right situation at the next level, and to where he's a guy that we look at and he's starting come week five.
I could see the Chargers looking at him. You know, it seems as if they're going, whatever the Chargers are going to do, they're either going to trade for someone like Cam Newton or they're going to draft somebody. Mm-hmm. And if they draft somebody, Tyrod Taylor will probably be the starter in 2020. Now, I would think that if you are building an offense that will accommodate Tyrod Taylor, then the transition to Jalen Hurts would make a lot of sense. You know, very similar stature. You could enable Jalen Hurts to learn the offense for a year, and then you bring him in either midway through the season or, you know, in his sophomore year. I could imagine Carolina showing some interest there. You're right. He's going to nail the interview process, and teams are going to just love the way that the whole Alabama situation and the way that he dealt with that, very mature, has produced, you know, a lot of stats and a lot of production and a lot of success for two big programs. He is, you know, he's used to the limelight being at Alabama and Oklahoma. And look, I think if you're talking like round three, I mean, we in the past, we were saying like day three, and now I'm thinking round three, and it's worth a shot, you know. Give that guy a chance to win a job, and I think he may well win it. And you know, there will have been teams will have looked at Dak Prescott a few years ago, and there's a reason why Dak Prescott lasted to round four. A few years on, why did Dak Prescott last to round four?
Right.
But we will have been talking about something at the time, like he doesn't do this or he doesn't do that. With Russell Wilson, I think it was really just the height more than anything. But you know, there are reasons why certain players drop, and that's not always right. And you can, and like Minshew was another one. Minshew looked poor at the Senior Bowl a year ago. He didn't look particularly great at the combine. And then you watch him and the guy looks like he was, there's just something about getting him on a football field in a real life football game and the magic happens. He's a magician. And, you know, I just, we'll see with Hurts. You know, I just thought that he was one of the most entertaining things about this combine. And I just love the fact that everything was with a smile and everything was so relaxed and the quality was there. And if I was a GM or if I was a coach, I'd have just give me a chance to win with that guy, you know, and it might not work, but we'll give it a shot.
I want to go back because we did talk about Denzel Mims a little bit already, but Nathan from Bloomfield, New York, he emailed in and says he was wondering if you could address after the combine what you thought about Denzel Mims because, you know, he hit that 4.4 mark and you listed him among your combine winners at the wide receiver positions. And he wasn't really a guy that I think that we talked about all that much going into the combine. And now is he starting to get a little more interest, or do you think he's somebody that teams are sleeping on still?
I think in terms of, first of all, going into the draft, it was very much a let's wait and see how he runs before, because he does a lot of the things the Seahawks like a receiver. So, you know, they like guys who can get downfield, who can, you know, big chunk plays, big yardage downfield, win at the red line, win contested catches, do all of that stuff. He's very, very much a Seahawks type of receiver. But the thing that I, watching him on tape, funnily enough, this is going to make you laugh, was I didn't know how fast he was. Mm-hmm. I didn't see amazing speed on tape. And then he ran a 4.38. And you're thinking, that's great. And it confirms that he could easily be on Seattle's radar. But then at the same time, that speed did not look obvious on film. And that's a concern because it's great to run a 4.38, but you kind of want to see – it has to translate, if you know what I mean. You know, right. You kind of have to say – now, with DK Metcalf, there was no doubt he was going to run a great 40. You know, he got downfield. He was unbelievable at just running downfield. I mean, the speed was always there. It was always expected he was going to run an amazing 40 time. I think with Denzel Mims, it was more of a surprise. And that's the only question mark I've got is how much does the 4.38 actually play out on the field? But apart from that, you know, he's got the profile that the Seahawks love. He is incredibly, it's just exactly what they want. It's perfectly what they want. If he's there at 27, then he could be an option for them without a shadow of a doubt. I liked his interviews at the Senior Bowl. He kind of had a bit of a pissed off vibe about him, you know, kind of like, I'm going to go out and show everybody. And I kind of liked that. And the momentum at the moment is that, because he performed and tested so well, and because he had such a great year at Baylor, that he may go a lot earlier than people were originally projecting. I thought immediately after the combine, I thought, right, he's firmly in the round two, you know, top 50 type of range. Yeah. But people seem to be suggesting he's going to go top 25 now. The thing is that not all of these players can go in the top 25. But if, you know, in terms of, does he fit the Seahawks? The answer to that question is a definitive yes.
Rob, I feel like with wide receiver, we have such a good idea of what they look for outside with speed and, primarily speed. I wonder what they look like for more of a possession type receiver, because that's what I think of when I think of what they need. And they went to DK Metcalf so often on third down, but you know, he had issues with drops. He had only, you know, right around a 50% catch rate. Tyler Lockett, he was another guy that they looked to a lot on third down, but I don't think he lived up to quite that reliability that you saw with Doug Baldwin on just his ability to get open so easily. And is there anybody in the draft that they could look to take on that role in the 2020 season?
I think that type of role, I think it's gone the way of the fullback, I'm afraid. I think that the possession receiver is no longer with us in the NFL. I think that teams want speed. And, yeah. You know, the Seahawks definitely do. I mean, everybody they've got, look, the history of drafting 4.4 runners, the big receivers run 4.4 that they've drafted. And it's not just DK, you know, it's Chris Durham, it's people like that as well. You know, they've always gone for speed. So and Doug Baldwin was not a big possession receiver type. He was quick, wasn't he? It was his ability to separate with, you know, unbelievable Allen Iverson type basketball moves that enabled him to be such a good converter of third downs. So what I would say to that is I think it's probably more likely that they would draft a smaller, quicker receiver or somebody along that who can maybe do the Baldwin type of stuff, which for me that would mean probably someone like KJ Hamler. I could imagine Jalen Reagor working into that role, but he's more of a downfield type. J- Justin Jefferson ran a 4.4, as we've already talked about. He was Mr. Consistency with LSU. I could imagine that he could perhaps do some of that. But if we're talking about bigger bodied players who do that, I think it's going back to Hunter Bryant again. I think it's a bigger slot. It's somebody who can settle into those soft zones, who you match up against the linebacker, and you know, he uses that sort of agility and quickness to separate and find, you know, there's nothing more frustrating, I find, in the modern NFL than a tight end who gets open on third down and just makes it look so easy. And it's one of the things the Seahawks don't really tend to do. You see teams do it against the Seahawks, you know, that they put the tight end in a matchup and then they get him into an out and they need, you know, third and six to get 7 yards. And they just sort of get to the sticks and they stick there and then they find them. And I'd love the Seahawks to be able to do that a bit more. So if we're talking about bigger possession receiver, I think Hunter Bryant might be the best option. But I think if we're talking smaller, quicker, it's that, you know, Doug Baldwin type. I think it's maybe some of the other names we talked about. I mean, there are a lot of 4.4 runners in this draft class, and there'll be people who improve their times at their pro days, I'm sure, in the coming weeks. So they will be able to find somebody who can do that thing.
I just want Michael Thomas on the team, Rob. And yeah, I feel like that's not that hard to ask. Just go out and draft a guy exactly like Michael Thomas.
Yeah, it's just go and draft Michael Thomas and also Walter Jones.
Right, draft him, yeah.
And Steve Hutchinson and Earl Thomas. And if they could get Sherman and Michael Bennett and Cliff Avril, then that'd be great. That'd just be fine.
We've just put together the Super Bowl 2020 roster, Rob. I'm glad we worked that out all in the span of an hour.
So you don't need to be a GM to... You just need to know how it works, and that, you know, we've sorted it.
I don't know why we're not getting paid the big bucks, Rob.
Yeah, it should be.
All right, Rob, big thanks once again. People, be sure and go to check out SeahawksDraftBlog.com. What do you got coming up, Rob?
A lot of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of stuff about free agency coming up, and, you know, we'll react to everything that happens. I'm going to sort of dig deeper into some of the players that I think fit. I'm going to do a post-combine mock draft because I did one before. I'm going to do one after. It's going to look a lot different to the mock drafts that you are seeing in the national media at the moment. And I promise you there will not be a cornerback at number 27.
That's all I'm asking for. I'm tired of seeing the cornerback. I've had enough. I've gotten out of the way all the corners that the Seahawks could potentially take at the end of round one. So appreciate you coming on, Rob. We'll look forward to talking to you again through the offseason. And I think with that, there's only one thing left to say. Go Hawks!